Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Newell, and I'm one of the partners here at the Harbor Group of RBC Dominion Securities, and welcome to the February 2016 Strategy Update Conference Call. I'm joined by my colleague, Robin Gullison, who is the lead strategist here in our team. For today, over the course of the next 15 to 20 minutes, we are going to cover off a number of topics, including a brief overview of our last conference call, our outlook on the markets, both in the short versus the long term, some of the signposts that we're looking for in order to become increasingly confident and constructive on our outlook for the market, and lastly, some of the opportunities that we see at this time. So to start with, we're going to have a quick review of the material that we covered during our last call. We did this in a question and answer format, and we received some positive feedback from clients, and so we're going to endeavor to do that again. The first question that we ask of Robin is this: is this a rerun of the 2008 financial crisis? Robin, care to weigh in on that, please?
Sure. Our opinion since that last call hasn't really changed all that much. In our view, this is not a rerun of 2008. While the recent volatility in the market has certainly been unnerving, we don't really see a lot of parallels to 2008. Back then, you had a major problem with the banking system and then the risk of the banking system imploding. Right now, some of you may have seen some headlines about bank stocks, particularly European bank stocks, performing poorly. But the big difference this time around is that's more about concerns over the amount of income the banks can earn in an era of negative interest rates in the European Union, as opposed to concerns over the balance sheet and the solvency of these institutions. So while that may sound like something that's similar to 2008, we think the root cause is much different. So we don't think we're looking at a rerun of 2008. In 2008, by this point, you were already in a recession. You had Bear Stearns collapsing about a month from now, I guess. I think it was March 2008 when Bear Stearns collapsed. You had the housing market imploding as well. We don't see a lot of those excesses that have built up, nor are they any bubbles being popped right now. So we don't think this is a rerun of 2008.
The second question is, how long will the current volatility last?
That's a great question, and one we'd certainly all love to know the answer to. You know, volatility typically stays dormant for a while, and then you get these spikes of volatility. And we went through an unusual period in 2012 to 2014 where you didn't have that much volatility in the market, particularly in the U.S. market. You went over 2 years without a 10% correction. That's actually what's unusual. Typically, you get a 10% correction every year to 18 months. Right now, we are in the midst of a correction, and you know, volatility tends to spike and then dissipate. Right now, we're in one of these volatility spikes, and we think over the next few months, as we get more clarity in the economic outlook, we think the volatility should start to subside somewhat.
How closely correlated is the real economy with oil?
Well, I think that's one of the big misnomers we've seen this year, is that the stock market is treating every tick in the price of oil as if it's a barometer for global economic growth. We don't think that's the case. We think what's happening in the oil market is a case of oversupply, as opposed to demand falling off a cliff. But the way the markets trade with the oil price, you would think that every move in oil was indicative of global demand. So we think oil is not the economy. The drop in oil is actually very stimulative for consumers essentially around the world, definitely very painful for oil companies and those that supply oil companies. But for the consumer, which is 70% of the U.S. economy, this is actually something that's very positive, and you've seen gas prices recently hit new lows.
Could you comment on the levels of sentiment in the marketplace? And specifically, we notice that stocks are up one day and down the next, and the fundamentals just can't possibly change that quickly. What's driving this?
I think you're right. It is largely sentiment driven. And you know, over the long term, it's been shown that the returns of the market are largely driven by what happens to the earnings of corporations and the cash flows they pay out to investors. In the short term, the market is driven entirely by sentiment. And I think if you think about it in extreme terms, over a one-day period or any given day, as you just suggested, the market can be up or down by a significant amount. But fundamentals barely change at all on a day-to-day basis, yet the market moves around significantly. So in the short term, markets are driven by changes in sentiment, and that changes the PE ratio, the price-earnings ratio, and that's how much the broad investment community is willing to pay for a dollar of earnings. So that can change a lot on a day-to-day basis. But over the long term, it's the earnings power of companies that drives the market, and that's how we focus our attention. We can't really control the emotion that people in the market shows in the short term. We can control what kind of businesses we choose to invest in and what their forward prospects look like.
Thank you. And I appreciate the update and the recap of our last conference call. Could you care to comment, please, on the short term for equities and linking that to volatility? Specifically, how bad has it been in Canada?
Well, I think what's maybe gone unnoticed by a lot of people, particularly if they don't have commodity-heavy portfolios, is that the TSX as an index is actually down over 22% from its high seen in 2014. So, again, a large part of that is due to the very significant weight in the TSX of commodity stocks, so energy, mining stocks, and the like. That's dragged down the index pretty significantly. You know, stocks that pay and grow dividends have done a lot better than that. But nonetheless, if you're a global investor looking at the world, Canada is down over 20%, which is quite significant. And what we think is kind of interesting is that Canada is much further along in this correction process than other countries such as the United States. So you've had a combination of bad sentiment and bad fundamentals for the commodity part of the Canadian market. But we actually think the fundamentals for other large parts of the market, so the consumer part of the market, the financials, et cetera, look a lot better than what we're seeing in the prices for the overall TSX.
And in the context of the long term, how substantial is this correction that we've been going through, and does it impact our outlook, and your outlook for that matter, for the long term?
The short answer would be no. Now, we don't want to be flippant and say that this doesn't matter. Of course, it does matter as we're living through it. If you look at the long-term chart on page 4 of the presentation that's on our website, you can see that, you know, none of these drawdowns look all that bad in the long term. But, of course, as you're living through them, they feel entirely different. But this is kind of the what we call the cost of owning equities, is having to live through this volatility. So the cost of being an equity investor is living through volatility, but the reward is a much higher long-term return than you typically see in other asset classes. And you can see here this chart goes back to 1945. The TSX price only is compounded at 6.4% back to 1945. And, of course, right now you can get a dividend yield of close to 3% on the index. So we think the forward return outlook for equity still looks quite attractive, particularly after the correction we've seen here in Canada.
One of the common questions that we get asked by clients is, why not just sell everything a year ago before all of this correction unfolded and avoid all of this damage? And why not just get out of the way of these short-term corrections?
Well, I think it sounds easy in practice, because it is. Selling is the easy part, I would say. Getting back in is the hard part, because once you see a market trade down to a certain level, if you're in cash, you have a hard time buying at anything but that level. So, for example, if the index corrects 20%, then it rallies 5%, and because the world looks better and it feels safer to get back in, we find a lot of time investors have a hard time buying at that new higher level because they've seen that low level and they want to buy there. But the major story, I think, is that none of these corrections look alike. None of them have any common denominators. There's different causes each time around, and a lot of times it's things that we think should be concerning people, and then nobody cares until they do. And they care about these things for a while, and then things move on. And a lot of times these problems aren't necessarily even resolved. They just kind of go back to the back burner. So I say no one correction is really like the others. They often have different causes, and to try to pinpoint them in real time is very challenging. And again, the big challenge for us is, if you get out, you have to time getting out exactly right. You have to get in at the bottom. You're going to miss the dividend payments, and you may end up paying unnecessary capital gains taxes on your sale before you get back in. So if you net that all out, unless we're facing something like a 2008, as uncomfortable as it may be, we think it makes sense to ride out the mild and moderate corrections.
Thank you. The next question that we get from clients frequently that I'll pose to you is, what are the signposts that we should be looking for to become either more constructive or perhaps more optimistic, or on the other side of the coin, to have a change in view and a change in perspective to the negative? You know, could you comment on a few of these, you know, call it signposts, if you will, that we'd be looking for?
Absolutely. I think the number one signpost we're looking for right now is the price of crude oil. It's particularly important for the Canadian economy, the Canadian dollar, the Canadian bond market. And that's not really a surprise given how our market is comprised and our economy is comprised. But it's also taken on an outsized effect for the rest of the world. And as I mentioned in my opening comments, you know, even though the drop in oil is definitely a positive for consumers, It's taken a while to see that savings being spent. I think we're getting close now. We saw retail sales in the U.S. last week, which were quite strong, so I think that's an encouraging sign. But the market, of course, likes to focus on the negative, and the negative is that oil companies are obviously losing a lot of money, and they're not spending nearly as much on capital expenditures. So that's hurting companies in the industrial sector, and that's what the market's really concerned about right now, as well as potential credit risks to banks that have lent to oil companies. I think one of the big differences is, from this versus 2008, is that, number one, the mortgage market in the United States is many, many, many multitudes larger than the high-yield energy market. Number two, the bad mortgages in the U.S. got repackaged so that they ended up in places they shouldn't have been, i.e., you know, junk mortgages got repackaged and labeled as AAA and sold to people who thought they were buying very, very high-quality paper. Most of the investors in junk-rated energy bonds knew what they're getting into. They may not like what they're seeing right now, but they kind of had an idea that this was possible and they got into it. So I think that's the big difference between the previous cycle and this one. That said, oil is definitely affecting the sentiment out there. And some sort of stability in oil doesn't even have to necessarily go a lot higher, but just to stabilize and get off the front page of the paper every day, I think would be a very large positive. And we're starting to see positive effects now in that Saudi Arabia, some of the larger OPEC countries, and Russia have proposed a freeze on production. That's what came out in the last 24 hours. Well, it's not a production cut. I think it does show that these countries are very well aware that if it keeps going like this, they're going to be in trouble, and they've got to do something to try and stem the slowdown in the oil price.
Thanks very much. And outside of the oil market, could you comment on another signpost that we would be looking for in order to become perhaps more constructive in these markets?
Yeah, another signpost we look for is what's happening in the corporate credit market. So this is bonds of corporations, and bonds of corporations trade at a higher yield than bonds of the government. And that difference between the yield on a corporate bond and a government bond we call a credit spread. So that's just the risk premium that investors demand for investing in a corporation over a government. Well, as you see on page 6, we've seen credit spreads start to move wider, so they've gone higher, or the risk premium has gone up from what we saw in 2014. Well, it looks dramatic on this chart. You see right now the average credit spread is about 1.21% or 121 basis points in financial lingo. Back in 2008, it was nearly triple this level. So again, we're not looking at a 2008 type scenario. But credit spreads are very important because that's the transmission of credit into the economy, into corporations, and if the bond market's not open for business, companies can't raise money to do share buybacks, which has been the main buyer of stocks this cycle, and it can't raise money to do mergers and acquisitions, which have also been a positive factor. So we need to see the credit market start to settle down a bit, and if these credit spreads start coming in, I think that'll be quite positive for the stock market.
Robin, what economic indicators are we looking at, you know, in our office as a firm, as an indication that the situation that we're observing in the market is just a market phenomenon, perhaps, and not a phenomenon that's impacting the real economy?
Sure. I mean, there are many, many economic indicators we watch on a daily basis to get a gauge on the economic growth situation. One of the ones we look at every week is the U.S. initial jobless claims. So these are people filing for unemployment insurance for the first time. Those have remained quite low, the lowest they've been almost in 20 years. So it shows that the firing side of the equation is quite low. You're not seeing a lot of people lose their jobs. You can also look at the amount of people who are voluntarily quitting their jobs, presumably to go get a better one. That's also at the best level it's been in over a decade. I mentioned the retail sales number that came out last week, which was quite strong. And if you look at page 7, we try and aggregate some of these things to show what the broader trend in growth looks like. And the left-hand chart on page 7 is the Atlanta Federal Reserve, they call it their GDP Now forecast. And what they do is they try and forecast the current quarter's GDP growth by looking at every economic indicator that comes in. And based on the data they have in hand so far, they think Q1 is coming in at about 2.7% growth rate in the U.S., which is not super strong, but very much in line with what we've seen since 2009. And you've had annual growth in the kind of 2 to 2.5% range, so anything over 2.5% we think is pretty good. If you look on the right-hand side, we have RBC's economic scorecard. This simply looks at the number of economic data releases coming in better or worse than expectations. If data is coming in better than expected, this line tends to trend up. If it's coming in worse than expected, it tends to trend down. As you can see, since about December, it started to trend up. So data in aggregate has been coming in better than expected. So these are the things we look at, and this is what kind of tells us, again, the stock market is not the economy. The economy is not gangbusters, but it hasn't been for years. But it's still steady, and that continues to be the case.
And a pointed question in this vein while we're talking about economics is, you know, what are the chances of a recession from this point forward, and are the markets pricing this in?
Well, in the U.S., I guess you could say that in any given year, the baseline risk of a recession is around 20%, because historically you've gotten a recession every 5 years, so, you know, that gives you 20% a year just as a baseline. The economic models we look at right now show that the probability of recession is maybe 1 or 2% higher than that, so 21, 22%, which is still quite low. Look at what the markets are pricing in. The equity market's pricing in probably a 30, 35% chance of recession. And as we'll get to a little bit later on, the high-yield bond market's pricing in a nearly 100% chance of a recession. So if we think the recession predictions are fairly accurate and the market's pricing in a much worse risk than we think is likely, that tells us that those markets are attractively priced.
Thank you. And then for your final signpost that we would look for, or second last signpost rather, you know, could you talk about the technical indicators in the market, and perhaps also just give us an overview very briefly of what a technical indicator is?
Absolutely. So there's a large swath of people in the market who look at the trends in stock prices and the changes in the values of stock indexes to determine what's going to happen next in the market. So they call that technical analysis. So that's, for example, when you hear people talking about trend lines. So if you look at a stock chart and it's kind of going from the lower left to the upper right, and you draw a line beneath it, and the stock keeps hitting that line as it goes up, they call that a trend line. Another thing we look at is what they call bottoming processes. So what we've had happen in the U.S. market in the last few months is what they call a retest of the lows. So the market, as you can see on page 8, put in a low of around 1810 on the S&P 500 in mid-January. Well, a few days ago, we also hit 1810 again. And often what you'll see happen is after a big sell-off in the market, you'll put in a dramatic low. So a dramatic low meaning that the market declines very rapidly and then tends to bounce back at the end of the day. And then a few weeks later, you'll often come back and touch that level again. And they call that a retest of that low in financial jargon. And that's what we had happen last week. We had a successful retest of the January lows. In the technical community, if you would have broken through that January low and traded lower, that would be very negative. But holding that level and bouncing off it is seen as a positive in the technical community, and that's what we had happen last week.
And if these technical lows hold, what sort of returns could we expect for the markets, you know, short and medium term from here?
Well, I think if those levels hold and we see data continue to come through and optimism returns to the market, on the U.S. side, to see the market rally another 5% would not be unusual at all. And as you go further out to the year, it's going to depend on what happens to the data, but to revisit the old highs seen last year wouldn't be out of the question if the economy keeps coming through.
And what about the Canadian market?
Canadian market's a bit of a different story. As I said, the Canadian market's much more further along in its correction process. It's all going to have to do with oil as far as the TSX as a broad index is concerned, because that's going to be driving the marginal change in the TSX. That said, if oil continues to improve, the sentiment towards our banks and larger companies will also improve.
And could you talk about your last signpost that you would be looking for in terms of indicators that we're watching?
Sure. The last one I'd say is the U.S. elections. And I think this one maybe is a bit underappreciated by a lot of people because, you know, I personally watch this as a bit of entertainment value, seeing people like Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders leading in the polls. But really, the market's starting to worry about this, because if you get one of these outsider candidates come in, nobody really knows what they're going to do, right? If Hillary Clinton becomes president or Jeb Bush, the market's pretty sure what their policies are, what they're going to do. You put Donald Trump in the White House and talks of building a wall and all these other things and ripping up trade deals, that could be a problem for the economy. So that's what people worry about, and that's what the market's worried about. And I think if you see a mainstream candidate emerge on either or preferably both sides, the market probably reacts well. I think in reality, even if one of these fringe candidates got in, that would really just guarantee more gridlock in Washington, D.C., and the market actually tends to like gridlock because nothing changes. You know what the rules are going to be. You know what the taxes are going to be in the budget, and it actually ends up being not too bad for the market. But I think the initial shock, if one of these people were to get elected, would be a near-term problem, and I think once you realize it's going to be gridlock, it, you know, it would resolve itself somewhat.
Thank you. So it sounds like you're quite constructive on the economy in the confines of a low-growth environment, and that from a technical standpoint, it may well be that the majority of the downside is behind us. With that said, as we look forward, where do we see opportunities? Could you talk about a couple of those, please?
Absolutely. So we see, you know, I say two opportunities here in Canada, one on more of a Canada-U.S. outlook. Number one would be the Canadian banks. You know, we've talked about this a few times in our previous calls. The Canadian banks, in our opinion, look very well valued. So Canadian banks are trading at a P.E. ratio of about 10, some less, some a little bit more. The dividend yield is near 5%. The price-to-book ratio is about 1.5 times. Typically, they trade at about 2 times. Typically, you see 1.5 times during a recession. And we also have the banks coming out to report in the next couple of weeks, and we think some of the banks could increase their dividends by as much as 5%. Now, the banks obviously have energy exposure. We think a lot of that's priced in. And what you typically see happen is once the banks start to recognize the losses, as long as they're not materially worse than expected, that tends to put in the lows. That's the indication we've gotten from our analysts here at RBC, so that's what we'll be watching for in the earnings releases. Second opportunity, I'd say, would be in the Canadian REITs. Again, we talked earlier about securities and markets that are pricing in a larger probability of recession than we currently have. Well, the Canadian REITs are trading at a discount to their estimated net asset value of about 13%. Now, you only typically see this kind of discount to net asset value in a recession. Obviously, a decent part of Canada probably is in recession if you think about what's happening in Alberta and the oil patch. But a lot of the assets of these companies are not in Alberta. They're in Ontario, Quebec, British Columbia, et cetera. So we think the REITs are pricing in a fairly dire scenario. You're getting quite a high yield on them, and we think this is an opportunity, something that's being kind of painted with the oil brush but isn't necessarily fully reflective of their businesses.
You also mentioned the high yield market as an opportunity. And could you, you know, first explain, you know, how far off of the highs from recently the high yield market is? And how does the average investor play the high yield market? Are you advocating going out and buying distressed bonds of individual companies, or do you do this via another mechanism?
Sure. Yeah, so the high yield bond market is pretty interesting because if you look back 2 years ago, the high yield bond market wasn't pricing in much risk in the world. You look at where it stands now, and the high yield bond market is trading at a yield or a yield spread. So again, the difference between the high yield bond yield and the government bond yield that is consistent with the recessions of the 1990s and the early 2000s. A lot of that has to do with oil, obviously, and you can see the chart on page 12 shows the energy index for high yield, and you can see that the yields on high-yield energy bonds are at or above the peaks you've seen in the last few cycles. And if you look at the table beneath, I apologize, the font's pretty small, but typically after you've had these kind of oil busts, you've seen very strong returns out of the energy part of the high-yield market. And you could say the same thing for the high-yield market in general. Once you get the high-yield market pricing in a recession, particularly if you don't get a recession, you set yourself up for fairly strong returns. As far as where you would access the high-yield bond market, we don't advocate clients go out and buy individual high-yield distressed bonds. That's a very dangerous game and very, very difficult to get diversification, even if you have a substantial net worth. And the liquidity is also a bit of a challenge. We think it makes a lot more sense to go with an index approach or a seasoned manager, and we have a few that we like in that sector.
Terrific. Could you also comment, Robin, please, on the Canadian dollar vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar? It's very top of mind for many clients, and it seems like not only has our stock market been exhibiting an extreme amount of volatility, but our currency markets have had the sort of volatility that you'd expect over several years inside of days and weeks.
I would absolutely agree. The volatility in the Canadian dollar has been quite breathtaking, and it's been all over the map just this year. I mean, to your point, we've had moves seen in the past 6 weeks that you typically see in a year. And that a lot of that has to do with, again, no surprise, what's happening in the oil market. Oil influences the moves in the Canadian dollar. It also influences Canadian interest rates, and the difference between Canadian and U.S. interest rates is a very strong factor for the Canadian dollar, sometimes even stronger than what's going on in the oil market. So we've seen very high volatility this year, and we expect that to continue until the oil situation resolves itself. Again, if oil were to settle down, we think the Canadian dollar will start trading more in line with what the outlook for Canadian growth and Canadian interest rates is. But as long as you have these multi-percent moves in the oil market on a day-to-day basis, it's going to be very difficult for the currency to escape that. Now, could you have another 5% rally from here if oil continues to go up? Absolutely. And, of course, if oil were to go back down to the mid-20s, you'd probably see the Canadian dollar go back down to its lows. So really hard to make a short-term call in the Canadian dollar without having a strong opinion on oil. Longer term, you look at the valuation of the Canadian dollar, we hit nearly 20% undervalued in the last few weeks. That's not typically something that's sustainable for a long period of time. So in our view, the big move in the Canadian dollar has already happened, but it's always that bottoming process in those last few cents that seems to cause a lot of consternation.
So, Robin, outside of making a binary call on the price of oil, which you've mentioned several times during this presentation, what sort of strategy should one have en masse when dealing with investments at this stage, you know, given the outlook for the economy and given the volatility that we've seen? Is there any one simple recipe for success that we can look towards?
Yes, there is. You know, the kind of all-weather strategy I'd say we follow has to do with dividend investing. If you go to page 14 of the presentation, we have a graph of the TSX going back to 1986, and it breaks up the TSX by five quintiles based on the dividend characteristics of the TSX. And there's one line that represents the TSX, it's the middle line on the chart, and that's compounded at 5.4% a year going back to 1986. So pretty typical return for the equity market. If you look at the bottom two lines, those are the companies that either don't pay or cut a dividend, and amazingly, those two lines have actually compounded at a negative rate of return since 1986. So investors in those securities have actually lost money cumulatively, which I find to be quite shocking. More interesting, of course, are the top two lines. The second line from the top is simply companies that pay a dividend. Those are compounded at 9.2% a year, going back to 1986. And the top line is companies that grow their dividend. That's compounded at 11.3% going back to 1986. So our strategy tends to be to invest in companies that are paying and preferably growing their dividend. We think this is a strong signal from management that their cash flows are sustainable and likely to grow in the future. And we think this is one strategy that should hold up well, even if we get a situation where interest rates rise, particularly companies that are growing their dividend, because that should help compensate from any change in interest rates, even though that feels a very long way off at present.
Thank you. You know, perhaps you have some parting words or could summarize what we've talked about today for our listeners, and especially those who perhaps have dialed in midway through the call.
Sure. So the first thing we did was went through our January 20th conference call, the major questions we'd be getting from clients, and quickly, you know, is this a rerun of 2008? No, it's not in our view. We think volatility will continue to be higher than what we saw in 2012 to 2014, but should subside over the next few months as we see some clarity on economic growth. Oil is not the economy. You know, the market has been trading as if oil represents the economy, but we think it's more of a supply problem than a demand problem in oil. Sentiment is extremely negative. That tends to be a good sign for contrarian investors because once sentiment is very negative, it doesn't take a lot to get the market going higher again. And lastly, in the short term, the market is driven by sentiment, but in the long term, it's driven by earnings. Second thing we talked about were the signposts we're looking for stabilization and better performance out of the equity market. The five things we'd like to see is stabilization in oil, a tightening in credit spreads, so corporate bonds performing better than government bonds, improving economic data, number three. Number four, a successful retest of the market lows, so we think we've seen that. And lastly, a mainstream candidate emerging in the U.S. election. Where do we see opportunities? We think Canadian bank stocks look attractive, Canadian REITs, and the high-yield bond market. And the last two things we talked about were the Canadian dollar, again, tied to oil in the near term. Longer term, we think we've seen most of the downside. And lastly, we think dividend and dividend-growing stocks are the bedrock of a long-term portfolio.
Thank you, Robin. And thank you all for dialing in today to listen to our February 2016 market update. And we will plan to have another one of these in the month of March. Have a good day.